All right, everyone, thanks for coming today. You can find a seat if you would like to in the back, and it's great to see all of you. I'm Corey Jackson. I'm a pastor in the PCA at Trinity Park Church. Until this weekend, I'm transitioning out of my role to lead Luke Alliance full-time. I'm also the founder and president of Luke Alliance. I'll be co-presenting with Hannah Nation. Hannah is the founder and managing director of Center for House Church Theology, and she'll introduce herself a little bit more fully in a minute, but I'll get us started. And today we're talking about advocating for the persecuted church, and so we'll spend a little bit of time developing a little bit of context around what does persecution mean and how we can learn from the persecuted church and how we can also advocate for them as well. Like I said, I've started this organization called Luke Alliance, and we offer pastoral care and global advocacy for the persecuted church, for persecuted Christians, and I'll explain more about that as I go along. How I got involved with this is really a meta-narrative of what's going on in the church in Asia and around the world. And what's happening is that organizations like Mission to the World, City to City, and others that we know have rightfully focused on evangelism and church planting over the last 20, 25 years, and even longer. And that has borne fruit. The gospel bears fruit. It's a dynamic power, and God is at work, and that's a beautiful thing. And many of the pastors, I was a missionary in China from 1998 to 2005, and many others were serving in the China and Asia region, and we were all encouraging people to know the Lord, to follow the Lord, some of those who were called to plant churches, go to seminary, follow Jesus in every way that they can. As they have been faithful over the last 25 years, we've seen the gospel bear fruit, and simultaneously, we've seen that be overlaid in terms of a political perspective with authoritarianism in the region. We've seen in China with Xi Jinping, and in India, for example, with Narendra Modi, in Myanmar with the civil war. We're seeing pastors who are being faithful, preaching the gospel, who are also now experiencing persecution at much greater rates than they were before. Some of those who are experiencing persecution are my friends, and I've seen them deal with this. I was in China, like I said, from 1998 to 2005, and this is a picture from 2004, and the brother here with my arm around him on the right, and the one directly in front of me were our church planters. Some of the other guys in the picture started Christian schools, some of them went to seminary and served in other ways. The guy on my left, who was also just involved in the movement, was the informant. His parents put pressure on him to report all of our activities to the school and ultimately to the Chinese Communist Party. And so all of these students, particularly the church planters, underwent great persecution. And I ended up with my wife needing to leave the country eventually because of what was happening there. So I saw persecution happening firsthand there. But then I continued to track, came back to from China in 2005, and went to RTS Orlando, planted a church, and continued to track with this movement, this gospel movement happening in China that is now in 190 cities and made up of about 5,000 pastors. I walked alongside this group. I can't say the name of the group in this presentation. Many of you have heard of it. It's all Reformed. It's gospel preaching. It's a beautiful movement of the gospel. I've been serving alongside many of these pastors as a board member. And in 2017, I rotated off the board. In 2018, back to 2017, I met this man who's in the center there. His name is Wang Yi. You may have heard of Wang Yi if you're connected to China. Hannah actually translated/wrote a book. Other people helped her translate, but she helped edit a book on Wang Yi that's very good, which she'll talk more about in a moment. But Wang Yi is a great and influential leader in China. He's here with Ben Chen, and the guy right in front of Ben Chen who's translating is John Piper. And I was sitting at a table for a minute with Wang Yi and John Piper, which is a really amazing experience in 2017. Here's another picture with me and Wang Yi on that day and a few other people. Well, in 2018, the church at Early Rain was targeted. This is probably the flagship church in this large network. And due to that, really a lot of things changed in terms of how we view engaging with persecution. I'm going to show you a video that describes what went on. This was produced by Early Rain Church themselves post-persecution. So this is about a 4-minute video that I think will help you introduce you to the situation a little bit better.
当你说你有爱的时候，当你说你要用爱来回应这一位爱了你的上帝的时候，我们要问的一件事就是，你身上的爱的记号在哪里？
But what we know this morning is that Wang Yi, a very high-profile pastor, as you mentioned, he's been in the Oval Office, he's a former legal scholar, he, along with his wife, Zhang Rong, and 100 Christians were detained early last week in the Chinese city of Chengdu.
按照长老会所准备的预案，现在四年之中的长老必须担负起末了全教会的责任。我们不会轻易放弃公开聚会撤回小组。如果还有一点点机会可以全教会一起敬拜，我们就绝不撤回小组。我们愿意付出更大的代价，来为福音在我们生命中的翻转之大能做见证。我们愿意200人、300人、500人都被他们抓起来、关起来。让全世界知道我们是为了信仰甘心乐意受如此逼迫。
世人看为愚拙，或看为荣耀，不为魔鬼控告，不怕人嘲笑，耶稣基督做我忠告。
6 years have passed. The brothers and sisters of Early Rain Covenant Church have endured countless harassments, summons, and detentions. Their homes are watched, their gatherings interrupted, their freedom stripped. Yet, they have never stopped worshipping or given up their faith. What kind of people are these? They are people who have received the signs of love. In one of his letters, Pastor Wang Yi said, "Our strength comes from God's fervent love for us. The courage we display before our persecutors is not the courage of heroes, but the courage of penitents. We have once forsaken all faith, and we can no longer forsake our faith now. Our steadfastness comes from the fact that we were forgiven by the Lord. We say, O Lord, you loved me and died for me. The king of this world cannot command me to leave you, nor can he drive a wedge between us. O Lord, from now on we reject this world. Not because we hate the world so much, but because we love you so much."
All right, so this is the story of Early Rain Church. I want to give you a little more context for persecution that's happening, not just in China, not just with Early Rain, but in the region and around the world, if it'll allow me to move forward. It's not. Let me go out and back in real quick. So just to give you context, like how prolific is persecution in the world today? So around 380 million Christians suffer discrimination at high levels, 310 million at very high or extreme levels. You can see how many Christians are persecuted globally, 1 in 7, 2 in 5 in Asia. And though what we've seen happen at Early Rain is tremendous, the reality is around the world, and this is only what's been reported, so a lot of this is underreported, you have 4,476 murdered, 7,679 churches attacked, over 4,000 Christians in prison for their faith. And again, these numbers are low. I'm just trying to help you understand that this is normal Christianity within the world today. Regionally, according to Open Doors, China ranks as the number 15 most persecuted in the world, Myanmar 13, India 11. And there's different reasons that persecution happens. In China, it's the government that's actually the one who is perpetrating the persecution themselves. In a country like India, they just remove protections from Christians, and so they're then targeted by Hindu nationalists. And it's different in every country for various reasons, but Christians are being persecuted widely throughout the world. You know, when I was in seminary, I think I took, we had one missions class. It was a very good one, but I didn't remember much. I remember one of the most prominent quotes that we learned, and I've heard this in many sermons growing up, that Tertullian has said that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. I do believe that in the meta-narrative of history, if you look at Christ's suffering and the ensuing persecution of the church following Christ, you see the church growing through persecution around the world over time. I think that's true. God does bless and grow his church through persecution. But if you look at the micro-narrative, you look at the individual stories of what is happening in the lives of those Christians, it's far more complicated than that. It's not nearly as triumphalistic as that. These are real individual human beings who are suffering for the gospel. Hannah's going to talk about some of the beautiful and powerful theology that they're writing as they suffer for Christ, and we can learn so much from them. But I just want to draw our attention to their individual stories. And also within history, it's not as simple as just that the gospel grows. You can look at Pyongyang, North Korea, which was called the Jerusalem of the East in the 20th century, the early 20th century. Egypt was the cradle of Christianity in the second century. These are no longer bastions of Christianity. So the reality is that though the gospel is growing through persecution, there are countries, there are situations where the persecution becomes so severe and so entrenched that it does stifle the growth of the church. And so advocacy is important. I was in Myanmar recently. I was in Kuala Lumpur. I was talking to people from Myanmar that have suffered for the gospel. And Myanmar, Laos, and Bhutan had representatives there. These are some of the most persecuted pastors in the region. And I just rolled out this statement: wherever the Church of Jesus Christ is persecuted, it is a great evil. And many of them just started crying because it just validated their story. They've heard Tertullian's quote or quotes like that, and they know that the gospel is growing through persecution. But they also need to hear and need to know that what they're experiencing for Christ is evil. And the fact that we have a difficult time expressing that, because we want to caveat it behind this meta-narrative of triumphalism, is something we really need to work on in the West. So what is persecution? It could be defined in many ways. We have defined it, just so that you know, when we're talking about persecution, we're not talking about just living in a country that's hard. That's the case for a lot of Christians. But we mean persecution, it happens when a brother or sister is physically, legally, financially, or psychologically targeted by a government official or other malicious opponent because of their faith in Jesus Christ. So when we're thinking through who do we need to help, we're thinking through this lens. Who is being targeted in these ways? What this means, it is not simply living as a Christian in an authoritarian state. There are some Christians that are okay. They're fine. Just because you live in China or India doesn't mean you're necessarily being persecuted. It doesn't mean leaving your country because you prefer a better life. There are people doing that as well. It doesn't mean being targeted for homeschooling your children. This is something in China that a lot of Chinese don't want to enroll their kids in the communist schools. I feel that. But just because you prefer homeschooling in your context doesn't necessarily mean persecution. It doesn't mean if you're targeted because you make political statements online about how bad your government is, that's not being targeted for the gospel. I'm just trying to help you understand that we're talking about persecution. We're talking about people who are really suffering, being targeted for their faith in Jesus Christ. And so I'm going to transition over to Hannah. She's going to talk about advocating for the persecuted church's influence in the Western church, and then I'll pick it up in just a minute. We're going to give her a second. She's got her knee card coming up here.
Thanks, everyone. I fractured my ankle last weekend, so a little bit limited on my mobility. So my name is Hannah Nation. I manage something called the Center for House Church Theology. And basically, our goal is to help share the voices of our brothers and sisters in China, outside of China, with the global church. We believe that what they are living and how God is leading them and teaching them has value for us who don't live in China and who don't speak or read Chinese. We believe that there's a lot we can learn from them. So we do that through mainly through translation and publication of their writings and their works, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a minute. But I want to open with several quotes. I'm going to be reading several quotes, so bear with me. This is a quote that I was reminded of recently from Tim Keller, and he's quoting a quote. So there are a lot of quotes in this section. So the quote is, when a newspaper posed the question, what's wrong with the world? The Catholic thinker G.K. Chesterton reputedly wrote a brief letter in response. Dear sirs, I am sincerely yours, G.K. Chesterton. This is the attitude of someone who has grasped the message of Jesus. Now, I think we all love this quote. I think this is a pretty well-known quote, both the original and Keller's use of it. And so my question for you is, do we believe this remains true when the church is under opposition? I want you to just sit for a moment and ask yourselves that. Do we believe when the church is under opposition that this quote is just as true for the church, that we are called to say, what's wrong with the world? I am. I want to read to you some quotes from my brothers and sisters in China. This is from Wang Yi. Corey just used it in the video, but I want to read it again so that we can kind of meditate on it for a moment. Wang Yi says, our strength comes from God's fervent love for us. The courage we display before our persecutors is not the courage of heroes, but the courage of penitents. We have once forsaken all faith. We can no longer forsake our faith now. Our steadfastness comes from the fact that we were forgiven by the Lord. We say, O Lord, you loved me and died for me. The king of this world cannot command me to leave you, nor can he drive a wedge between us. This next quote comes from a woman I know who spent 2 months incarcerated for pastoring a church. And this was her reflection that I had the privilege of recording after she came out. She said, at first, I really wanted to leave that place because those who were kept there with me were all thieves or drug dealers or prostitutes. But praying the Lord's Prayer helped me recognize who I was and what God's will for me was in that situation. On the third day that I was there, I suddenly understood and surrendered my heart to His Lordship and began to pray every day for the 40 cellmates who were there with me. As I prayed, forgive my debts as I forget my debtors, God helped me face my own sins. In particular, He helped me face my idols, the idol of comfort and worldliness and the idol of wanting others' approval. We had little privacy in there. We were often strip searched, and we did not have much food and had to sleep on a floor. But God used all of that to deal with my idolatry. And then lastly, this is from a pastor whose reflection I had the privilege of sharing or publishing in one of our books. He says, "What we need the most now is to repent rather than to stay strong, to confess our sins rather than to boast of ourselves, to bear responsibility rather than to shift blame, to speak up rather than to keep silent." So I share all of these quotes because I think they're a really interesting follow-up to Chesterton's quote. And I think they're such a good example of how and where our brothers and sisters in China speak to our current cultural moment. Many Christians in the U.S. today feel very afraid of the future. We feel like we're not sure what our future holds. We feel culturally marginalized. And so we have to ask ourselves, does Chesterton's reflection on the problems of the world still stand when we feel like we may not be safe anymore? And our brothers and sisters in China very clearly say, yes. The number one thing we have to learn from the persecuted church in China is that there is only one gospel, whether that is in freedom or in opposition. The problems and the answer of the gospel are the same, whatever our context is. I think the second thing that we have to learn from them is that we are called to love and serve the city, even when it doesn't love us back. That is also something that doesn't change according to our context. It may be harder to love the city when it doesn't love you back. It may not be as fun to love the city when loving the city doesn't mean getting to move into a nice house in downtown Washington, D.C. and working a fun job, right? Sometimes loving the city means sacrifice and service and taking risks in order to love the city, but we're still living out that calling no matter what our context is. And then lastly, I don't have time to go into this a whole lot, but the Chinese house churches that I work with, they love the doctrine of union with Christ. Now, In general, I find in the West, there are many people who are rediscovering this doctrine and who really love it. But it's still kind of relegated to the soteriology debates. And it's not necessarily something that we think of when we think of like, oh, how do we live in this world? I don't know how much we've really explored the applications of this theology. But our brothers and sisters in China talk about this as like a living reality and a living doctrine that makes all the difference in their Christian life. And in particular, they talk both about the fact that suffering is part of our life with Christ. Scripture, Paul in Colossians 1:24 talks about how we fill up the afflictions of Christ. We live Christ's life that he lived here on earth. Connected to that, though, is also, of course, the ascension. We live that reality currently as well. And so the house churches have this beautiful way of talking about these two things. Now, for them, they're very familiar with suffering. And so for them, the power of this doctrine often is in discussion of ascension and how ascension is real in our lives today. I think for me, as an American Christian, I probably am a lot more familiar thinking about like ascension and all the benefits of union with Christ than I am with thinking about my call to suffer with Christ. That's not really something Americans like to talk about. It's not really part of the American dream to talk about suffering with Christ. And so I think it's a good example of where they are blessed by thinking about the ascension reality of union. We are blessed by being reminded from them that we are also called to walk the way of the cross with Christ in this life. And so it's one doctrine, it's one gospel, but we benefit from meditating on it with each other. So this is just a really short taste of why I think it makes sense for us to listen to people from the persecuted church in the Western world, that it's not just a matter of what we have to offer them or what we can give to them, but it really is also a matter of learning from them and listening to them and helping them speak to us. In a lot of ways, you can think about this as advocating for their voice in the global conversation, helping to promote and push their voice forward. It might not be the most immediate thing we think of when we think of advocacy, but it's a very important part of it. I want to read you one last quote. This is from Bonhoeffer's Life Together. And I recently reread Life Together, and I read it trying to think about how we can live this out as a global Christian community. Life Together obviously was written for the local context and the local church, but I really believe there are global applications to be found in it. So let me read this. Bonhoeffer says, "The first service that one owes to others in the fellowship consists in listening to them. Just as love to God begins with listening to his word, so the beginning of love for the brethren is learning to listen to them. It is God's love for us that he not only gives us his word, but also lends us his ear. So it is his work that we do for our brother when we learn to listen to him. Christians, especially ministers, so often think they must always contribute something when they are in the company of others, that this is the one service they have to render. They forget that listening can be a greater service than speaking. Many people are looking for an ear that will listen. They do not find it among Christians because these Christians are talking where they should be listening. But he who can no longer listen to his brother will soon no longer be listening to God either. He will be doing nothing but prattle in the presence of God too. This is the beginning of the death of spiritual life, and in the end there is nothing left but spiritual chatter and clerical condensation arrayed in pious words. Brotherly pastoral care is essentially distinguished from preaching by the fact that, added to the task of speaking the word, there is the obligation of listening." We talk a lot about the global church. We talk a lot about being a part of the global church. Part of our call as the global church is to listen to and take time to hear from our brothers and sisters around the world. If we want to be in fellowship as the global church, then it's our responsibility to learn to listen to each other, to learn to listen to those, especially those who are persecuted, so that they have a voice in our conversations. It's a huge honor to my brothers and sisters in China whenever I get to tell them that you all are listening to what they have to say. It blows their minds when they think that there are American pastors and leaders who care about what they are experiencing and care about what they are writing and what they are preaching. It is not just an academic activity to read a book by a Chinese pastor. It's, according to Bonhoeffer, our first obligation of brotherly fellowship to our brothers and sisters in China. So, how can you actually do this in your churches? It's, in my opinion, fairly simple. I would really encourage reading books from the persecuted church. I've helped publish books from China, two books, but there are others out there that speak to other contexts. And so I would really encourage just you yourself, read something from the persecuted world. Read about their experiences, read about their theology. Second, I would teach your church to listen to the persecuted church. You can do that through your preaching, who you reference in a sermon, how you talk about them in your sermons. In your community groups, we have a study guide that we created to go along with this book focused on a community group setting. And then, of course, adult and children's education. And I think children's education is actually a really important piece of this as well, helping our children to think about the global church and the persecuted church. And I would just lastly say, as you do these things, do it with the intention to find fellowship, not to other the persecuted church, not to say all the ways that they are different, but to rather find fellowship with them. That posture will make a very big difference in how you engage these materials and how you think about these things. I want to turn it back over to Corey, but if you would like to follow the center and the work that we do, you can sign up for a newsletter on this QR code, and I'm available to chat with anyone after we conclude. I need a backup beeper.
And I would commend Hannah's work to you. They do amazing work. So that was advocating for the voice of the global church. I'm going to talk about advocating for the persecuted church before global leaders. So why does advocacy matter in the more, I guess, traditional sense of the term of raising our voice for the voiceless? Well, Jesus said in Matthew 25, 35, and 36, "I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me." Back to the story of Early Rain Church. I knew these men. I knew this was happening. And it really began to bother me. On that day, about 300 people were arrested. About 45 people were held in administrative detention. Criminal detention, which is for longer than 14 days. Many of the elders and deacons and seminary students and staff were tortured, and we knew about this. And so I had an opportunity to go to Washington and advocate for them, which I'll get into in just a minute. But it began to really bother me, this quote from Jesus, this burdened me. "I was in prison and you came to me." And the question is, how do we do that in countries that are in the deep, dark prisons of places like China or India? And the only way we can really do that is through the work of the state. So what is advocacy? It's could be defined as raising detailed awareness among those in authority and asking for tangible help for our brothers and sisters who are suffering for Christ. And so I have developed a strategy for advocacy, but just to make sure that you understand what it's not first, advocacy is not lobbying for legislation change. I'm not working with Congress on policy. You'll hear I do work in Washington, but I'm not doing that. I'm not affiliated with any kind of a politician or political party. It's not playing politics. One thing I like to say when I'm meeting with people in power is that this is a nonpartisan issue. The persecution of the church is nonpartisan. It's a problem for everyone to be concerned about. But we need to build a theology of advocacy. So why should we be involved with this? Well, we call ourselves Luke Alliance. So Luke wrote Acts. The only way you know that Luke wrote Acts is through the pronoun we that runs throughout the book. And so occasionally there are these moments where you're thinking like, okay, Luke was with Paul, but he's not drawing attention to himself. So we find ourselves in the role of Luke telling the story of persecution that's happening to the Chinese church and others that are writing this theology, that we know the data about. We're telling their story, and we're in the background, putting the focus on them. Proverbs 31, 8, and 9, there's many other places that you could go in Scripture, but speaking up for and defending the rights of the poor and the needy, those who don't have a voice for themselves. Romans 13, actually the next seminar after me is talking about the role of the church in politics in a much more detailed way than I will. But we can understand God's expectation for nation states. One of the basic expectations is there would be freedom for worship, that there would be the opportunity to worship God. And the role of Christians as we relate to government is a big question, one that I'm not going to fully answer here. But if you are in a state like China and you need to relate to your government, the way we see them relating to government is praying for those who persecute them. They express the fact that they're experiencing injustice at certain times, but they do so non-violently. They do so trusting in God to be their vindicator. That is how they relate to the Chinese Communist Party. We see them and we witness their response. So in the United States, how do we relate to our government when we are in a more free society with more justice happening than they are experiencing, with freedom of worship, freedom of religion? Our role, I would argue, is to raise our voices to the more free governments of the world, to call upon them to hold the governments accountable that are not promoting religious freedom. It is raising our voices in places like Washington and London and Germany and in the UN, and encouraging them to hold people like Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi and others accountable. Otherwise, they have no accountability in their situation. So that's the role of nation states as they relate to each other. So how do we do advocacy? So as soon as this happened at Early Rain, it happened on December the 9th, 2018. On December the 18th, I had an opportunity, and I'll be brief here, to go to Washington. The Lord provided me some opportunities to do that. And I went, I had an opportunity to speak on Capitol Hill. Actually, on December the 17th is when the global news caught the story of Early Rain, and it began to go viral on BBC and CNN. The CNN news clip, I'm sure, was from around December the 17th. And God had orchestrated that I would be there on the 18th, and I had an opportunity to go and speak on Capitol Hill, and I was invited to the White House under Trump 1 and Pence to speak with them. I was there for about 3 hours, and they connected me with the State Department, who connected me back to Capitol Hill. And God began to build relationships in Washington. And then later, you can see me, this is Wang Yi. This is the only picture we have of him in prison from 2019. That was also in the video. This is me that first time I went to the White House with a friend of mine. And then the U.S. government has begun to connect me around the world. This is me speaking at the U.S. ambassador's residence in Prague. They've also sent me to Berlin, to Geneva. And when I go, all I do is I tell the story of what's happening to the Chinese House Church. I specifically highlight cases of what is happening in areas of diplomacy where they should get involved, particularly with Wang Yi. And then I share the gospel, because the most obvious question that can be asked is, why is this happening to the Chinese church? You can see from the picture, there are people from many faiths represented. There's 60 diplomats from around the world were gathered there that day. And so what matters in advocacy is knowing the persecuted person or family. So before we ask for anything for anyone, we're always making sure that we have as close of contact with the family as possible. We want to bring clear and not sensationalized, accurate data to government officials. And then we want to make specific, tangible asks to our government leaders of how they can get involved in diplomacy related to these folks. We've had some success stories. Zhang Rong is Wang Yi's wife. She was also arrested with Wang Yi back on December the 9th of 18. And after about 6 months of our advocacy, she was released from prison. And the U.S. government has told us that they would not have focused on her case had we not raised our voice. And I was just blown away that I'm a regular pastor in the PCA, and to be able to go and speak up for those who don't have a voice and to see our government officials get involved and to orchestrate her release was unbelievable. We've seen better treatment for Wang Yi. Wang Yi expected to be arrested. He gained 30 pounds before he was arrested, because he was expecting that this would probably happen to him, but he didn't expect for his wife to be arrested, and he didn't expect for the rest of the elders and deacons to be arrested. So Wang Yi expected to be in prison. I don't know if he expected to be in prison for this long, but we have gotten him better treatment. We've gotten visitation for his family to go and meet with him. He recently was able to see his son, which was for the first time in 6.5 years, which was an unbelievable thing. John Tsao is another pastor. When he was released from prison, he was in prison for 7 years in solitary confinement for 1 year. And when he was released without, in China, what's called a hukou, or basically it's like identity papers. So he couldn't ride public transportation. He couldn't go to the hospital. He couldn't just do basic things. And so we helped him hire an attorney who got him his rights back. There's a lady named Pearl who she was in prison with two of her friends. One of those friends, upon release, committed suicide because of what she experienced. Pearl, oh, you're good. I was like, is that my video? Pearl came to the U.S. We helped her rehabilitate with post-traumatic stress care, and she's now gone back as a missionary to a minority people group in China. We also have pastoral care teams and pastors' wives teams that we have helped fund to go visit people as soon as they're released from prison so that we can help them navigate that first mile after persecution. So we at Luke Alliance, we focus on advocacy before our global leaders. We also focus on pastoral care. I was getting into some of that at the end. I don't really have time to cover that. But essentially, advocacy before, you know, in Washington and Europe is reserved for the most persecuted people, the people in the most dire situations. Not every persecuted person needs or can receive that level of attention. But for the all those statistics we just looked at, what I'm hearing from China, what I'm hearing from India and other countries is that, you know, persecution is on the rise, and there are many people that are experiencing persecution. So we're coming alongside organizations like City to City, MTW, and others so that they can continue to focus on all the things they're doing well, and we can help them think through how do we build pastoral care ministries that are contextualized in their countries and regions to help pastors and pastors' wives and other ministry leaders who, you know, you may think, oh, they're, well, I don't think any of you think this if you're a pastor, but it's easy to think, oh, if you just understand the gospel and believe the gospel, you can successfully walk through anything. Hypothetically, that's true, but in reality, we all need community. We all need, sometimes we need counseling. Sometimes we need specialized care and treatment. And we in America have come to expect that that's normal. We want to resource pastors and Christian leaders. And places like China and India, they just don't have those resources. So we're seeking to help build resources for the least resourced Christians in the world who are, in fact, many of them are the most gifted leaders in the global church, just don't have the resources that we do. So we're trying to tip the scales back in their direction a little bit from here. So I'll end with that. Hannah and I would love to take Q&A from you. And if you have any thoughts or questions, we'd love to answer those for you. I don't know if Hannah can come up or not. We'll see, but she'll make her way. But any questions for us? Oh, yeah. I'm going to go to the last slide real quick. Yeah, I had to skip over some stuff. So, but while we're answering questions, if you want to sign up for our prayer list or our newsletter list, you can do so with those there. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm going to promote these for you.
Sure.
These are two great books. It's Faithful Disobedience. This is mostly Wang Yi in this book. It represents his theology really well. Wang Yi doesn't have a lot that's translated into English, unfortunately. This is a great book. This is a collection of writings called Faith in the Wilderness. I've read both of these. They're great. Handed out to many people. These are both great resources. As she said, I don't know of the other books. Maybe you do. There you go. Come on over.
Mm-hmm. Easier said than done.
How about you stay there and I'll come over next time.
I can help you figure out some books from other authors. There's not a whole lot that's translated directly from writers into English. But there are other books out there that at least talk about and discuss stories from beyond China. And I can help give you some of those names afterwards. So we also have we have articles on our website. So if you go to housechurchtheology.com, there are free access articles that you can download there. There's also another organization called China Partnership that has a blog. So if you just go to chinapartnership.org and find their blog. And the last thing I will plug is that I'm also involved with a podcast. So if anyone likes podcasting, it's simply just titled the House Church in China Podcast. It's on both Spotify and Apple Podcasts. We also have a website for it. But it tells stories from the house churches. We basically build the podcast story from extensive long interviews that we do with different leaders. So if you like podcasts, that's a really, really great thing that you can use as well.
Supposed to restate the question too. So Hutch asked, how long is Wang Yi's sentence for? As for 9 years, he's served about 6.5 years of that sentence. So I think it's up in 2028 sometime, because he was eventually sentenced in 19. So, yeah. Yeah. So is the belief that he'll be, how will he be treated after he's released? We believe, based on the other elders and deacons who have been released, that he will be released at the 9-year mark. Although he is different, he's on a different scale, so we don't know for a fact. We do believe that if he is released, I believe he will probably be under house arrest and have very limited freedom. Knowing the kind of person he is, I think he'll continue to try to figure out ways to preach and speak out. And so it's highly possible that he would be rearrested, but we'll see. But yeah, we would expect him to be released, but then to have preconditions on that, I would think. How's the church Early Rain? Yeah. So how's Early Rain doing? That's a really complicated question. So since the crackdown, they have split into many congregations, much smaller. They meet online. They've had to very carefully use technology to navigate how they meet. They only try to gather for, this would resonate with a lot of you, for the sacraments, because they believe those should be done in person as we do. And so they'll do preaching online, but they about quarterly try to congregate for Lord's Supper and baptisms. And back in September of this year, they experienced a great amount of persecution when they had one of those sacrament services. Even though they're trying very hard to abide by the law, they believe they must do that in person. And so they had one elder after another that was arrested and taken out of the service for just trying to lead through the Lord's Supper. And after the fourth, I think it was two elders and then two deacons, I think. Maybe it was three elders and one deacon, I can't remember. They then just shut down the entire venue and didn't allow them to take the Lord's Supper. So we were able to get the Wall Street Journal to write an article within 10 days about that. And they told the whole story of what had happened. And those men were released about 4 days later. I mean, it's hard to know if there's a one-to-one, you know, ratio, but we do feel like there are ways to use media that might be different than you see media being used in a lot of ways to sensationalize stories. But when you can use media appropriately to highlight a real atrocity, then it can be helpful. But Early Rain has experienced a lot of challenges because of this. You know, suffering produces a lot of things in you. It can produce humility. It can produce this prayer for your enemies, the things that Bonhoeffer, listening to one another. It can also produce pride. And frankly, that's been a challenge for that church. There's been some divisiveness on how do we, and this is not just Early Rain, but writ large in China, how do we face persecution? You can be prideful about the way that you respond to persecution. And it's not always producing the fruit of the Spirit. And so you can pray for the Chinese church, because this extraordinary pressure that they're under, it creates conflict. And we're seeing that. So if you want, yes. Yeah. Well, that was the last part of my presentation that I skipped over. So you can advocate for your neighbors in the United States. I don't believe people experience persecution in the United States, but I believe that we have persecuted people who live in the United States, who were persecuted and came from China or other countries and now live in the United States. And so in the immigration conversation, I realize this is like an atomic bomb right now, but I would just say this. that of the 4 million people roughly that are claiming asylum in the United States, I don't know about all their stories, but some of them, even if it's like 500, let's say, there are legitimately persecuted people who fled their country to come to the United States. And I think it's on us to listen to their stories and to locate them and to find them. And some of what I do is also advocating for those Christians who are now in the United States with our own government leaders. And I'm finding that our government officials actually want to know who they are. They don't want to deport the wrong people. So if you know someone who has a legitimate claim to asylum, then I would encourage you to talk to me or someone else, because actually every state senator has someone that works for them that is an immigration expert for them, because senators can't know everything, obviously. And so they want to know if there's someone in their district who is a person who has experienced real persecution. So I would say for sure that Chinese people that live in the United States right now who have experienced persecution and are here are worried in the moment that they might get caught up in the whole immigration conversation and might get missed. And so I don't think we want that to happen to anyone. None of us want that to happen, whether you're from China or Iran or wherever you're from. So I hope we can help those who have, you know, fit the definition. You've been targeted for Jesus' sake. So I think you'd be great for our country to be here.